0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. While we're awaiting the verdict on Gerard Hutch from the Special Criminal Court already, the Special Criminal Court this morning has delivered its judgment on two men who were also the co-accused, so to speak, Paul Murphy of Swords in Dublin and Jason Bonney, and both of them have been found guilty of facilitating the murder by making vehicles available to the criminal organisation. But we should remember, in all the mayhem and the theatrics, in one sense, of today and the 52 days of the very important trial, that we're talking about the death, the murder of a 33-year-old man who was a father and a partner and a son, David Bourne, and that should always be remembered, regardless of the circumstances or what people think around what happened or what happened subsequently. Many, many people have died, but that trial is specifically about the death, the murder of a 33-year-old young man, David Bourne. I first met Jonathan Dowdall when he was a Sinn Féin councillor in 2014. I was presenting prizes to in a brilliant school in the inner city, Rutland Street School. I've had connections with it over the years, and I've always looked forward to the annual prize giving and acknowledging great, great efforts by an incredible teaching staff and incredible students. And that's when I first met Jonathan Dowdall. He was a Sinn Féin councillor. He came up to me afterwards. He looked extraordinarily dapper. He's a small man. He looked extraordinarily dapper, three-piece suit, waistcoat, double cuff shirt, a tie pin, which I remember was too wide for the small tie he was wearing, but that's a stupid thing I would take note of. And he was very affable, and he was talking about his plans as a Sinn Féin councillor. He was telling me he was from the area. He was telling me about his business. He was telling me about all the number of people that he employed. And he seemed to be well regarded, insofar as you can judge that in a half hour conversation. He seemed to be well regarded and very eager young man. And that was in 2014. So we move on to Liveline in March 2016. And remember, the Regency happened 2 months previously in 2016. And then the year before that, there was this savage attack on a man called Alex Hurley. And we'll be talking about that horrific incident later. Alex Hurley himself will be talking about it. What happened is that Jonathan Dowdall's house on the Navan Road had been raided, very publicly raided. Well, it's a very public and busy road, and there was lots of publicity about it. And one of the things that struck a lot of people is a Garda water unit, the sub-aqua unit, were involved in a search in a semi-detached house in a suburb in Dublin. But anyway, that's one of the things people might remember. And Jonathan was very anxious on Liveline to explain, as you will hear, that he was totally innocent of any involvement in crime. Now, this tape was used extensively during the trial, which, as I say, we're awaiting the verdict on Gerard Hutch. It might not come before 3 o'clock, by the way, but regardless, this piece is worth listening to because, as people are saying, the veracity and the guilt and innocence of Gerry Hutch depends on whether the three judges believe Jonathan Dowdall. They sat in front of him. They believe him. Now, anyway, we'll let that unfold over the next period. But it will revolve around whether Tara Bourne, Justice Tara Bourne, Sarah Berkeley and Grainne Malone, those three women, whether they believe Jonathan Dowdall's evidence, because that's what it's pivoting on. So you can listen, if you wish, back to Jonathan Dowdall. Now, remember, when somebody rings Liveline, and you can criticise me for this as well if you want, but I have to presume that they're innocent, even for obvious legal reasons, but I have to presume they're innocent and let them state their case if they wish to state their case publicly and they choose Liveline on which to do it. This is going back to March 2016, the 11th of March. Jonathan Dowdall, he was in his house, phoning from his house on the Navan Road in Dublin. Jonathan, you're all over the front page of the a lot of newspapers today about your house being raided. What happened?
Life is upside down at the moment, Joe, to tell you the truth. My family are in an awful state. My daughter won't go to work. She won't go to college. My house was raided, and as you see, other than that, I didn't make it public, but the guards did that. They notified the press, as far as I'm aware. And the house was raided under Section 9 as being a suspected member of the IRA, and they were in search of firearms and explosives. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason why I don't know why that is. It was a complete shock to me. The first I was seeing and knowing of it was a lot of armed guards coming to the house. I just happened to be able to open the door on time, and they didn't burst through the door, and then I was held at gunpoint in the house. I was more than cooperative to the guards. Mm-hmm. They were looking for an office that we left 3 or 4 years ago, and I told them our office was around the back, and they were there from people. It reported in the media that they were there from yesterday morning, which it wasn't true. They were there from the night before, from 7:45 that night.
Okay.
They turned the house, told us to get out of the house. I wasn't cautioned or arrested at any point or questioned about anything, and I don't know what it's in relation to, and they wouldn't let me. If I left the room, I was held at gunpoint. I put the dogs away for them to search the house. At one point then, when we did leave, my wife came back to the house, and there was a guard sitting in the house on his own at 10 o'clock. We thought he was searching the house through the night. He was sitting there on the sofa with a machine gun watching the telly. Joe, we run a business, as you know. I met you before. I've run a business since 2007. I've never been on a social welfare payment in my life. I've worked my whole life. I ran in the elections. I'm sure I've no criminal convictions whatsoever for a breach of the peace probably 20 years ago. I've no links, connections to criminality or any crime organisations in any shape or form. Like any business today, my company is always overdraft. I borrow, which I've proof of, I borrow money from the credit union around the corner certain weeks, and I'm waiting for payment to come in to pay the lads so they don't go home without wages. Mm-hmm. It's not a cash business in any shape or form. It's an electrical company, and I can't name the companies for legal reasons, and hopefully they will be supportive to me till I straighten this out. But it's all big international companies, and they're bank transfers. It's a 60-day credit term, 90-day credit term, and it's not a case where I do a reword on 5,000 or 10,000, or I'm claiming when money is put in account. That never happens. It's every penny is traceable. The car that there was 4 cars, company Jeep. There was my daughter's car, which is a Mini, which is in my name, which is, it has finance on it, along with the Jeep has finance on it. They didn't take them. They were letting me take my BMW that night, but they searched it. But they moved it into a spot that looked good for the press, and they said the reason why they weren't let me take it was they were to search it again. That car has finance on it, or previous to that, which had finance on it. And like, up to this day, I'm still breaking my arse like everybody else to pay for the car. My motorbike, right to the point of buying it, has proof for everything on it. The police notified the papers about a pond. Other than that, they've never seen that. The divers in my pond.
Yeah, tell us about that. Tell us about that, John, because the Garda Subaqua unit arrived at your house on Dunavon Road. What was that about?
I keep Japanese koi, Joe, since I'm a kid.
Okay.
And I keep bad dogs as well. And I was always fascinated by fish, and it's a hobby. And I keep them, and I've docked our friends and all age, and I'm actually good at keeping them, and I grow them up, and I'd sell them on to some of my friends, or we'd swap fish, and that's what I do. It's a hobby. I built it myself. I built my home. I planned permission, everything. And the Herald quoted in the paper, which is a categorical lie, that there's no tax returns or anything filed in my... the firm has failed to file returns since 2013. That's a total lie. On the CRO, isn't filed all right for 2014... that the taxes are paid, and the way a company works is you pay your taxes and then you go for the CRO.
You're saying you are up to date. But what
both myself and my wife personally were up to date up to this year, Joe. The companies I work for, we need a higher security level to work for them in the first place. You can't get work if you haven't got a tax clearance there. So that's all lawyers. I've no money in the banks anywhere, Joe. Like, I struggle to pay the way that, like, everybody else in this country that employs people, they struggle to keep their company going.
I understand.
So I don't even drink. I went to see Dale on Saturday night. Before that, I haven't been in a pub in months. Like, my car, I do have a nice car job, but I worked my whole life from it. I'm working since the day I'm 16. If there was any criminality stuff to do with me, it would have been out during the time of the elections. The police have no... There's nothing there, Joe. Like, this.
Okay. And Jonathan, why did the Garda Subaqua unit go in to search an aquarium in a house?
It's in the back garden.
Yeah, but he hardly climbed into it.
I don't know. I wasn't here, Joe, so...
And is it big enough to climb into?
Oh, it is big enough, yeah.
Is it indoor or outdoor?
It's outdoor.
Oh, it's outdoor, okay. It's a pond, is it?
It's a pond.
Okay, and what, they waded through the pond. They said they could have emptied the pond, but they didn't want to inflict any cruelty on the fish.
No, in fairness, Joe, guards have to do their job, and if the guards... A lot of the guards here were very respectful and they were helpful, and some of them went, and, you know, guards have to do their job. Joe, that he set the media up, two of them, pretending they were knocking at the door at 9:45 when they were in there from the night beforehand. I'm not grateful, Joe, that now I'm in a position where I'm going to lose my company. Lads that have mortgages that work with me. Joe, I have a massive mortgage.
Oh, God. Okay.
For 800,000. I have a mortgage of nearly 400,000. I've got no massive, I've no big money in bank accounts or anywhere, you know.
But the BMW that was in the newspaper is on the front page of the Herald again today.
Yeah, that's on finance, Joe. I've a loan for it, like everybody else in the country.
But it's an expensive car, and it's that, what's that company that does up cars, Hamann or something?
Joe, come here, that's it. Listen, I like cars since I'm a kid.
Okay.
I always had a car. I had a car previous to that, which was a 20, exactly the same as that. The wheels that's on that car, so that BMW, for everything there, I'm not forgetting. It's just a coincidence as well. All the financial documentation of that car, the higher purchase and all that, was clearly there to see.
Okay. Now, Jonathan, when I met you, just if you to try and hold the mobile phone, it's going in and out there.
Sorry.
When I met you, you were a Sinn Féin councillor. I was giving out awards in a local school, and you were involved. And then people told me you were involved in a load of local projects. Why are you no longer a councillor?
Well, Joe, first of all, just to go back to Sinn Féin, they raided they raided, I believe, from watching the media, everybody else, up to 40 houses.
Yeah.
They've named and tried to shame me across the media because of a link to Sinn Féin. Now, that's a political stunt, number one, to destroy Sinn Féin and drag Sinn Féin into this. When I'm no longer involved as with Sinn Féin, I'm no longer in Dublin City Council. So what to destroy Sinn Féin as part of this? And that's the only reason why. Like, the big cartels, scum of this country that they're raiding, and rightly so, aren't all over the papers. And seeing houses they raided, and it took them 8 hours from looking at the media, and there were 24 hours of mine. I've no criminal convictions, I've no connection to any crime. And on the Late Late Show, which I'm sure you watched it as well, Paul Williams had a dig at Sinn Féin, part of this. Bob is Sinn Féin.
But did you not fall out with Sinn Féin?
Regardless whether I fell out with Sinn Féin, I didn't. Still.
Okay, so
certain people I had health issues at the time, and then there was certain elements within, you know, some grassroots members that that they were carrying on in a way I didn't feel was right, and there was issues during.
Okay, so the line unfortunately is deteriorating, but you're saying you didn't fall out with Sinn Féin, you're still friends with Mary Lou, who's a local TD and lives not too far from you as well. Okay. Now, when Jonathan, when did the Gardaí leave the house?
They left last night at, I think, about 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock.
And were you there when they left?
No, when they raided the house, what happened was they...
How many of them came into the house?
I don't know, 10, 15 armed. Up to the teeth. I've never seen guns like that in my life.
What are you saying? Machine guns, handguns?
Machine guns. If I went to the bathroom, there was a machine gun in my back. If I went to make a cup of tea, I went out to lock up the dogs for them. I brought them. They were actually, you know, we had an office where the office was. I brought them to it. We opened it for them. They raided it. We told them we had access to a shed, which I didn't have to. They raided it. Then they raided us. That we clearly told them wasn't theirs. That was in the building, and they raided them. With no consent to raid them.
Look at the timing of it, Jonathan. There was the raids in Crumlin on Tuesday. There was this big story. That was Tuesday. There was this major story on Wednesday morning that at the same time they'd stopped the car in Slane and found, now this was a speculation, they found the three, AK-47s that were involved in the Regency.
You know, I've seen that in the media myself, but the warrant issued to my house was issued on the 4th of March, but they executed it on Wednesday. So there's no connection between what happened to that incident, which I don't know anything about, to mine.
Do you know the Hutch family or any of the Hutch who are, you know, all the speculation?
Joe, you know the way the inner city works. I'm sure it was the same with Ballyfermot. Everybody knows everybody in the inner city. It was part of my job. I sponsored, as you said earlier on, I've done a lot in the community there, and I still do. And I sponsored the football teams, the boxing teams. And of course, I know members of the Hutch family, and some of them I'm very proud to know. And there's some of them that I don't know. And a politician from Christy Bourke will say the same.
I know that.
So, you know, just because somebody has
a name,
of Coach is it the father, one of the fathers there, is a good friend of mine since I'm a child. He's been in the media all along. The man has no involvement in crime. I know that man. That man is a friend of mine, and I class him as a friend of mine.
Okay.
And this is probably links to why this is happening.
And are you back in the house now, John, with your family?
Oh, yeah, my family are traumatised. I'll just give you an instance. We're doing work for a particular company in a massive big building in this in Dublin. Okay. And one of my staff members was greeted by a management figure of that company today with a paper put in his face and asked him what's all this about. I'm going to lose my company over this. I'm going to lose my...
Okay.
I won't be able to send my daughters to school. I won't be able to sell them to college for no foundation and no evidence, Joe. And that's true because I'm a Republican and because there's some stuff going around, and I'm a Republican.
Jonathan, what did the Gardaí actually take from your house? They took the car, did they?
They took the car that had finance on it. But, Joe, this is the point, right? There was a Mini there that had finance that's in my name, and there's a Jeep there that's a dear equivalent price that has finance on it. That's a newer car. But it just didn't look flashy enough to put on the back of the truck.
Okay.
So there's finance on those, all my vehicles. But more about there isn't. Through the years, I've bought bikes, traded in bikes, got finance on the bike before that one had finance.
And there was stuff on the paper that the bike could do not to 200 in 4 seconds, or whatever, all the size of the bike. Jonathan, when the Gardaí were leaving yesterday, how long were they in your house for? Was it 24 hours?
24 hours, Joe, but I wasn't afforded the right to be in my home when they were searching.
But as they were leaving yesterday, did they say, you'll hear from us, or... get a solicitor, or what did they say?
They didn't. Well, obviously, I'm going to engage with a solicitor, and I have done, but she's actually downstairs at the moment, and I'll put a media statement out. But, Joe, just to be clear, I have all up-to-date tax cleared in my hand for the company and for me. I owe no taxes. Like, everything I've ever made in my life is documented.
Okay.
You know, it was a raid for Section 29... suspected member of the IRA, what it was supposed to be, I don't know.
Okay.
And it turned into them taking cars away. When, since 2006, paid all my taxes, all my life.
Okay, now I get that point. Just you faded in there. It's clear you paid all your taxes. You say you've got documentation to prove it. And how is your family now, Jonathan? How's your wife and your children?
They're in bits, Joe. Why do they make something so like public?
Okay.
They were good enough to notify the media, but they didn't tell them why they were here. They led us to believe that I was involved with the Kinahans. I've never met the Kinahans, spoke to them, or been in their presence, or any of those in my life, Joe.
Okay, Jonathan, look after yourself and your family. I know it's your number one priority, but thanks for that. That's Jonathan.
I'm worried here. Like, I've worked my arse off to buy that car, number one. I've worked my arse off since I'm 16. My whole life, through the day they handled it, it's going to be torn up. Joe, that's not fair.
Okay.
You know, like, there's up to 9 electricians probably that have mortgages that are probably going to lose their jobs. I've had millions of, probably up to 20 lads through the years, apprentices in the inner city that would have never got the opportunity to get that. I gave them that job, and they've done it themselves.
Okay.
And that's, Joe, I'm well regarded in the north inner city.
Okay.
I'm not involved in crime.
Well, we now know, taking his last phrase there from Jonathan Dowdall, he was involved in crime because a year previously, just subsequently emerged as a result of that search of his house in 2016. The Gardaí found USB sticks and videotape and a recording of Jonathan Dowdall and his father savagely beating a man called Alex Hurley, who we'll hear from after the break. Also, remember that when Jonathan Dowdall was talking to us in March 2016, as I said earlier, the David Bourne had been shot dead in the Regency 3 months previously. And about a week previously, this infamous bugging device that the Gardaí, incredible work by the Gardaí, incredible work, the bugging device that they planted in Jonathan Dowdall's car. They planted a bugging device in the car, and now whether they did it, they'd obviously done it before. Don't be thinking, oh, the Gardaí did it when they seized the cars. No, the Gardaí did it long before they seized Jonathan Dowdall's car. And that's the 8 hour tape. Tapes feature a lot in all of this. The 8 hour tape that Jonathan Dowdall spoke about in the Special Criminal Court in the 52-day trial. Now, the court has resumed. I'm reading Paul Healy, well-regarded crime correspondent from The Star, who's tweeting every few minutes, and he's quoting, "The court is satisfied that there was a dispute between the Hutches and the Kinahans. Dowdall's relationship with Patsy Hutch, he borrowed money from him, also recommended him for carpet laying work. He stated in 2016 that he was asked, this is the verdict read out by the judges, he was asked by Patsy to get help from IRA connections to assist in the Hutch family in their dispute with the Kinahans. The prosecution submitted surveillance recording of a conversation between Dowdall and Hutch," just referred to it there, "and it supports their case as it establishes he was in control of the weapons and tacitly spoke about the crime." Ms. Justice Burns added, "The case against Gerard Hutch is that he was one of the two gunmen. The case is that he was alleged, obviously, that he was present as an actual shooter. This case is based off the evidence of Jonathan Dowdall." And we'll keep you updated as best we can, because it's ongoing as we speak. But after this break, I'll talk about the phone call from the man. Now, remember, you heard Jonathan Dowdall. I've done many times, I've listened to this tape. Every time I listen to the tape, I hear something new in it. He kept saying, "There's nothing there, Joe, there's nothing there." He had savagely attacked this man. He knew he had been on a journey north with Mr. Hutch in the very recent past. He didn't know the car was bugged. And he did know what they spoke about, because that's the totality of the key to his evidence. And remember this, the guilt or innocence of Gerard Hutch in the next hour or so, maybe longer, it depends on whether the three judges believed the man you've just heard for 20 minutes there on Liveline, Jonathan Dowdall.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie, we're following the verdict as best we can from the Central Criminal Court, or sorry, the Special Criminal Court. That's very important to remember that. It's three judges, no jury. Now, when I was asking Jonathan Dowdall there about had he any involvement in the crime, as you heard, there's nothing to it, he said. Well, one of the items found in his house in that raid he was complaining about was a tape, and that tape showed Jonathan and his father of imprisoning and threatening to kill a man called Alex Hurley, a completely innocent man who was, he thought he was buying a motorbike. And you heard Jonathan refer to his love of motorbikes and cars since he was a child. And Jonathan and his father were convicted of imprisoning, falsely imprisoning and threatening to kill Hurley. And in April 2018, Alex Hurley was on Liveline and described his ordeal at the hands of Jonathan Dowdall and his father.
And Alex, when they tied you to the swivel chair in the garage in that house on Navan, on the Navan Road, the two of them were there. Somebody took video footage, so we won't go down that road. But anyway, the two of them were there. The father was threatening to cut off your fingers, I think, at one stage with pliers. And did they say this out loud to you? This is what we are going to do.
Yes.
And what did you say, or how could you react to that?
Well, apart from being in shock and absolute terror, your initial reaction is to say, please not to. But you just freeze up in that type of a situation.
And then at one stage, Jonathan Dowdall waterboarded you.
Yes, he did a number of times.
Did he use that phrase, or where did he get that idea from?
To waterboard?
Yeah. Where did he even learn how to do that?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know what, you know, I really don't know where he would have professed this type of act or, you know, learned these techniques. I don't know.
And then shaving, did they actually shave your head with an electric razor?
Yes, they did.
And what in the name of good God were they attempting to do?
I don't know. I think it was all part. It was obviously part of their act or part of their agenda as to what they were doing. The torture that they wished to inflict.
Did you think you were going to die?
Yes.
Did you say to them, "Please don't kill me"?
Yes, I did. Yes.
And what did they say?
They said, You're not going anywhere. You're not leaving here alive.
When you pleaded with the father and son, did you have a father and a son? Did even one of them say to the other, "Well, listen, hang on, this is, let him go or leave him be"?
No.
Well, did
somebody, another individual in the background, obviously convinced them. They went out of the room to talk or to converse or whatever they do. Mm-hmm. And they came in and they said, "We'll let you go, but there's terms or conditions attached."
And what were they?
One of them was to leave Dublin, never to return. Mm-hmm. And then there was threats impinged against me and my family. If that condition was breached.
And you're saying the father and son were egging each other on rather than restraining each other in the violence and the threats of violence?
Well, from what I could see, it was a joint support act. But I can't confirm that. But from what part I seen of them, you know. Like, I don't know what happened when they left the room, but from what I could see, yes.
Did you know you were being filmed? Your torture was being filmed?
Yes, I did.
God. Did they say why they were filming it?
If the terms were breached in terms of, as I explained, it would be placed on YouTube.
Okay. So it was blackmail?
Correct.
Okay. Now, Alex, tell us how you came in contact with the Dowdalls, please. Just to give people who don't know the background to it. Were you selling a bike or buying a bike? Because we know he was into... And
I was looking to purchase one.
Okay. From them?
Yes.
Okay. And that's how you arrived in their house on the Navan Road?
Correct.
Okay. Did you ever see the bike?
I did, yes.
Okay. And how did they turn on you?
Apparently the father enjoyed my company, or they enjoyed just whatever, the chat, and there was a dinner invitation extended. Mm-hmm. And although I thought it very well odd at the start, they said that they enjoyed my company or whatever was the case at the time when I first met them. And then I said I would accept.
Yeah.
After severe convincement from Jonathan. And I attended, and then that's when, after arriving at the house, that's when it all changed and turned into a nightmare.
And you believe that was a trap?
Yes.
Okay. Were you aware that he had dogs?
Yes, I was aware. I was told he had dogs, that I was going to be their next meal.
How long did this ordeal last for? Can you pinpoint it? Or?
I can't specifically pinpoint it, but it was 2 hours or so.
And how did you finally get out of that place?
I was released and I was dumped in a remote part of Dublin. And told to get out of Dublin and never return again. Otherwise, you'd be dead.
Did anyone, again, I don't want names, did anyone appeal in what was happening? Did anyone, either the two men, the father and son, or indeed anyone else, did anyone appeal to them to stop and let you go? Apart from yourself, obviously. You were begging them.
No, not that I'm aware of.
And were you aware of Jonathan Dowdle, because he wasn't the public eye, were you aware that he was a counsellor?
To be honest, I wasn't, because I didn't really pay much attention to it. And forgive me, it might sound naive, but
did he reference the fact that he was a counsellor? Did he reference that he was in Sinn Féin? Did he reference any other organisation during the torture?
Yes, he did. He referenced the Sinn Féin and the counsellor aspect, and he told me that I was silly to mess with him because he was involved with the IRA, apparently.
What was the father saying in all of this? The older man. Well, both of them are not young men, but the father obviously is much older.
I think he was just, from what I can recall, I think he was just backing him up, backing up those statements there.
But wouldn't you think that a father would restrain a son?
That's what you would think, but apparently not. And to be honest with you, I thought it was horrific that, you know, these type of actions took place, in terms of that, you know, you would think that a father, from a father-son point of view, you're learning the simple things in life, you know, that we might, you know, you might curse your father when he's trying to show you how to do something in the house or something in life a particular way that's the proper way, but you mightn't see it as the proper way, you know. But obviously not in this case. Mm.
And who was the one who said, "I have the pliers, I'm going to cut off your fingers"?
That was his father.
And did he have a pliers?
He did, yes.
Oh, God. And were you aware at the time that, could you see them? Could you see the pliers?
So they're in his hand.
And by the way, both their faces were not covered.
Not all. No, the father's wasn't. Jonathan was for a period of time, but he didn't.
He gave up on that then, did he?
He gave up on that, yeah.
He was so confident that day, it scared you so much, there was never a possibility that you would ever go to the Gardaí.
Correct.
Yeah. You had not reported it to the Gardaí?
I hadn't made any approach at all.
Why not?
Because of the level of threats that was involved.
You were living in fear?
Correct.
And did you say to me earlier they threatened your family as well?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And did they know where you lived?
Well, they didn't tell me specifically, no, but when you have those types of threats inflicted upon you, you don't exactly, you know, take time to doubt or to question it, you know.
Alex, how do you feel?
Once the trial is over, you have to shift your mindset to rebuilding your life and rebuilding your own reputation, in terms of the fact that, you know, you have to try and pick yourself up from such an experience. You have to dig deep in terms of remain positive and to find that way in life to be more more, you know, to find, to rebuild your life and to progress forward and try and put that to the back of your mind. Like, as I say, physical wounds in any injury will always heal quite quickly, but the psychological issue in terms of, you know, trying to erase that type of ordeal from your mind, it's not easy. It's a lot easier said than done, you know?
Yeah. And that was Alex Hurley, and you heard the horror of what that gentleman, and he came across as an absolute gentleman, came through. And I just hope Alex is doing okay, because, as you know, Jonathan Dowdall and his father were convicted of that attack, and that's what they're serving the sentence from. Now, to give you more updates on what's happening in the Special Criminal Court, from Paul Heady, chief reporter with the Irish Daily Star. And remember, this is the judges reading out their verdict. So it's a narrative. It's a narrative. But it's there. It's what they took from all the evidence over the 52 days. And that's critical. What they judge to be important or not. Still, Jared Hutch's two co-accused have been found guilty. And the verdict is now being delivered on Jared Hutch. And it looks like it's going to be a long, long verdict. A long, long narrative. They say, I read some of it out already, Jonathan Dowdall contacted Pearse McCauley, an infamous terrorist. It would appear, according to the judges, he was an acquaintance of Jonathan Dowdall. He was to meet Kevin Tyrone. This meeting did not occur, but he met Shane Rowan, and Shane Rowan was referred to there in the tape. Shane Rowan is the man, and he's already served a sentence, by the way. This is the man who supplied the guns to the Kinahans, or to the Hutches, and he is the man that they were going up to meet. And you can read interviews, by the way, done by Paul Healy in the Star over the last few weeks with Shane Rowan, who's now, you think he got 5 years for possession of those guns, and he's now out. Apparently, the Dowdall family making bookings, these are hotel bookings for a Patsy, was not unusual. He got onto his wife to make the Regency booking. This is the narrative, according to the judges, what they are taking from Jonathan Dowdall's evidence. And Jonathan Dowdall, as you know, is the chief prosecution witness in the case against Jared Hutch. Patrick Dowdall, the father, who you heard mentioned there as well, and is currently serving a sentence. Patrick Dowdall paid in cash, this is the Regency, and got the key card. The arrangement was that they were to bring it to Patsy Hutch's house. However, the brother of Jared Hutch, and his son, tragically, he's been unfortunately murdered in the meantime. However, they then got a call to meet at Richmond. It's Richmond Road, that's my understanding. Dowdall claimed that they ended up meeting Jerry Hutch there. Again, this is all in Richmond Road. It's just in Fairview in Dublin, a short distance from Clonliffe Road and a short distance from Croke Park for people outside the capital. On Sunday, the 7th of February, Sunday World, according to the judges, ran a front page which included a photo of Kevin Murray. Just for your information, he was a man that kept being referred to as Flat Cap. He's now dead, by the way, and unfortunately he died of a long illness. A photo of Kevin Murray and the man dressed in drag. You remember those photographs? Photos were pixelated and unrecognisable, Judge Bourne says. In the last few minutes, Dowdall identified Patrick Judge and said in fact that this was not possible given that the photographs were pixelated. In the course of his evidence, Dowdall, he initially put the meeting with Hutch in a park on a Sunday or a Monday. He later said it was the day Eddie Hutch was killed. He recollected it was being approximately 11:30 in the morning. Now remember, Eddie Hutch, who lived in Ballybock in Dublin, a taxi driver, and by the way, thoroughly, by all accounts, decent man, because after the Regency killing of David Bourne was on the Friday, and the place was febrile. Dublin was febrile. The part of Dublin I live in, anyway, was in Clontarf, and I saw on Twitter around 8 o'clock on the Monday night that there had been a shooting in Ballybock, and I headed down there immediately. And the Gardaí were just arriving to cordon off the area. But Eddie Hutch had been savagely murdered in front of his family. And then I think a few days later, we got a phone call from a complete stranger who had come across Eddie Hutch doing a random act of kindness to her when she was in this taxi. But anyway, the date of Eddie's murder that Monday is part of Dowdall's recollection of a meeting in the park, which is a pretty important meeting as well. Dowdall stated that Jerry Hutch was in a panic. People had called to Eddie's house, that's Edward Hutch, and asked for Dowdall to contact people in the north. Dowdall claimed Hutch said it was him and them, Jared Hutch said, it was him and them at the hotel, and said he was not happy about shooting the young lad, David Bourne. Dowdall claimed Hutch was agitated, upset. This is the meeting in the park on that Monday. Dowdall indicated that he wanted out of the park and that he had no intention of contacting anybody, although he indicated to Jared Hutch that he would, anybody in the IRA. Afterwards, Patsy made a similar request to him. He claimed another man called Wee in the course of the trial, W.E., contacted him and they heard it was the Hutches in the Regency and asked how did Kevin Murray get involved? And Kevin Murray, as you know, is flat cap. Then Dowdall said to Jerry was looking to talk to him. This is the IRA man. Dowdall said the contact was made by Wee for Hutch to meet IRA men. Dowdall said he was asked to bring Hutch, Jared Hutch, to Rowan's house. This is the man previously mentioned, the IRA man, on the 20th of February. And this is the tape that was the journey that was taped for 8 hours, went through the north. Dowdall stated he did this. They went to Strabane and met Kevin Tyrone. Hutch allegedly wanted others to step in. Dowdall indicated he was constantly being contacted by Jerry, Patsy and by the dissidents. Patsy asked him to lie about the van and tell guards he had possession of it at the time of the Regency. He told Patsy Hutch he would not do this. This is Dowdall's evidence, but it's been recalled by the judges. Nothing of this so far do we know was true or not, according to the verdict of the judges. Dowdall said he was under immense pressure at this stage and was taking pills. Him and Hutch went up again to the north, to Strabane. Initially, they met this man, Wee, and Shane Rowan, and three other men. They had a very short meeting with these three to arrange to meet with the Kinahans to stop the feud. Miss Justice Burns is now talking about the tapes and the background to the guards getting permission to record the pair on the 7th of March 2016. This audio, according to Justice Burns, captured a conversation. The identity of the participants in this conversation is not an issue. The Northern Ireland portion was unlawfully recorded but admitted as evidence. In other words, the car went out of the jurisdiction, but they weren't to know that when they were planting the bug in the car. So they didn't get I don't think you can get a permission from another state unless you go through a lot of rigmarole to get a tape. But anyway, the audio captured, this is the judges, the audio captured a conversation. The identity of participants is not an issue. And the Northern Ireland portion was unlawfully recorded but admitted as evidence. The court is determined to exercise its discretion to admit this evidence, she said. Generally, she says, the prosecution said it establishes Hutch had authority over the weapons and that there are admissions by him on tape to involvement in the Regency. The judges say the prosecution assert one point in which Hutch says on tape correlates with the events 2 days later in which Shane Rowan was caught with the weapons. He was caught. I referenced that in the interview with Dowdall, and Dowdall said he knew nothing about it. The prosecution asserts that the three yokes are the AK-47s, and Hutch, this was a phrase used all the time in the conversation, and Hutch had control over them based off what he says about bringing them up north. Throughout the recording, the judge says there are other references to the yokes and giving them as a present. The prosecution rely on the evidence to assert Hutch's control over the weapons, she says, and I'll bring you more as I can from Paul Healy after the break. And it's the narrative we're hearing, and thanks to this man, Paul Healy, we're hearing it, and he's a very reliable journalist, we're hearing it minute by minute, which is the first time I've come across something like this. But back with more after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Again, from the Special Criminal Court, these are, I'm reading tweets, so I hope I can put them together in the in the proper sequence. Dowdall told him, this is Jonathan Dowdall told Jerry Hutch that he was in this with him to the, quote, bleeding death. Dowdall was heard saying he'd do a deal where people responsible for Eddie Hutch's murder would be given up. No one convicted of that yet or charged. Dowdall told him he had more balls doing that and all. This is not your fight. It can't all be left on your shoulders. Now, then goes on. There is a, the judges are saying there is a danger where a witness may not tell the truth in the hope of receiving benefits in the witness protection program. Remember, Jonathan Dowdall has not been admitted yet, by the way. He's under guard of protection, but he's in prison, but his family apparently are under guard of protection. But he hasn't, as such, been formally admitted to the witness protection program. Miss Justice Bourne says it's well established in law that evidence of an accomplice should come with a warning in it where it is in any way considered in the absence of any corroborating evidence. That's from the judge in the last 5 minutes. Miss Justice Bourne says it is well established in law that evidence of an accomplice should come with a warning in where it is in any way considered in the absence of any corroborating evidence. There's danger where a witness, as said, where a witness may not tell the truth in the hope of receiving benefits. The trial must bear in mind, it's dangerous to convict of such a witness if there is not corroborating evidence. Now, Mrs. Justice Bourne, in the last 3 minutes, is talking about the reliability of Jonathan Dowdall's evidence. And as I said, and you listen to a tape of him at the start, and then you listen to Alex Hurley, you can judge yourselves. But as I said, the whole conviction of Jerry Hutch now pivots on whether, totally pivots on whether, Dowdall is believed or not, and whether the telephone, there's enough corroborating evidence to substantiate what Dowdall is alleging. Dowdall, she says, as we know, is serving 8 years for false imprisonment, threat to kill, and assault causing harm. And that was to Alex Hurley, who we heard a few minutes ago. In June 22, he and Hutch sought to have evidence against him dismissed. Remember, both of them were charged together. Then Dowdall decided to go state witness. This application failed. In December 2021, Jonathan Dowdall's solicitor contacted Gardaí about the possibility of providing information, in other words, going state witness. His solicitor had conditions such as he wouldn't be cautioned and that his statements wouldn't be disclosed to a third party. Investigating Gardaí said they'd consider, but said they couldn't agree to conditions without knowing broad parameters of this info. And that's as up to date as I can give you as we approach 25 minutes to 3 o'clock on this day. Let me go to one of Anne McShane. Anne, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Good afternoon.
Okay, you're a sister of Kay McShane. Tell us the issue, please.
So, firstly, to say a little bit about Kay. Kay was a Paralympian athlete. Mm-hmm. She was one of the first Paralympian athletes in Ireland, never mind first women athletes to get involved. She won medals at the 1988 Paralympics. She also won a number of marathons, including the London Marathon, on three consecutive occasions between 84 and 86. Kay died in December 2019, and after her death, there was a really nice piece in the Echo here in Cork about her life and her achievements and her dedication to equality for people with disabilities. The management in Spike Island contacted us and asked us if we would like to have an exhibition at Spike Island, because she's from Spike Island, we're from Spike Island, our family.
Okay, and just to remind people, I visited Spike Island a number of times. It's a wonderful visitor centre at the moment. You go out on a ferry, but I visited Spike Island in another capacity a number of years ago when I was a probation officer, because it used to be part of the island, and that's important to clarify for people. Part of the island was a prison. And a pretty secure prison, and it was used in the 1980s for detaining. There was an epidemic of joyriding in Dublin, horrific epidemic, especially as young people were being killed, both those who were on the footpath, so to speak, and those who were driving the cars recklessly. And Spike Island was regarded and touted by the government, Michael Nunn, at the 90 Minister for Justice, to be the answer to these couriers. Put them in Spike Island and that'll soon soften their cough. It wasn't too long before they all got together and they burned down Spike Island and they escaped onto the other part of the island, which did have, as you say, and they're still there, did have houses belonging to the Irish Defence Forces. So that's how you were reared on Spike Island. But today, Spike Island is has been, the prison itself has been turned into a magnificent visitor centre. But anyway, keep telling us a story about Kay and what has happened.
Okay, so in the visitor centre, there's a community section, which is about the families on Spike Island, the army families on Spike Island. And when they contacted us, what they wanted to do was include Kay's achievements, her medals, her trophies, and photographs of her participation in that exhibition. It was upstairs, so we said, no, it's got to be accessible. There's no way that we could have an exhibition on her life and achievements without it being accessible. We couldn't have something where Kay herself wouldn't be able to visit it. So, but that was all fine. We were told by the team that it was all in hand. There was a pontoon, there were ramps. It was a completely different situation to how it had been when you would have visited, Joe. We went over in 2021, and Michael White, Kay's husband, is also a wheelchair user. And while he had problems getting on and off the ferry, the biggest problem was the bus. So there's a passenger bus, and we thought he could get on the bus. But no, there are steps to get onto the bus, and therefore he was not able to get on the bus to go up to the fort. So if you remember, it's a steep hill. His grandson, who's, you know, a fairly big fella, thank God, he pushed him up the hill and took him back down the hill. But the whole situation, the whole experience was really, you know, like a bad one. It felt unsafe, and it really just wasn't good enough. So we said to them, because we'd already agreed this will be accessible, we said to the team, well, look, you know, will you sort this out? And we offered to fundraise, to do everything we could. I mean, this for us was a joint effort. You know, we were working together. And they said, it's all in hand. It's all in hand. No problem. And then this kind of continued over the next 2 years up to December 2022. In the meantime, we had actually gone and paid for an engineer's report to help them see what the issues were. And he said, like, he pointed out to different things, but he pointed the bus being the main issue. Now, we're not talking about wanting to change anything about the historic buildings on Spike Island.
Okay.
We just want the bus to be made accessible. And then in January, I got a letter from Spike Island Development Company, which is a wholly owned public company, saying that they wouldn't have a permanent exhibition for her anymore. It would be a temporary one, after which we should take away all her stuff from May until September. They would put that in near to the canteen area. I think it's outside the toilets. But they would make no commitment to adapting the bus. So that's when we decided as a family, we just can't keep battling on this on our own. This is bigger than us. This is about people with disabilities in Ireland today and being able to access that exhibition. And it's kind of what her life stood for. So we went public. And taken us up now, to the company, where I'm today.
And the company say, and I know it's down as a company, but it's supported by the county council, isn't it? And they've done other things on the island. They've had apparently a very successful crime writers symposium over a weekend. But this is a statement from Spike, and a lot of them are, as you know, volunteers and totally dedicated to it. And I've seen that bus you're talking about. I thought when I saw the bus that day, I wouldn't have minded getting into it, but it wasn't for everybody. It was, seemed to me, for staff, for transporting food or whatever. And if anyone needed and was able to get into the bus, i.e. people with a walking stick or whatever, they would be brought that uphill journey. Statement from Spike Island: as the tourist season for 2022 was challenging regarding visitors' numbers and with increased operating costs felt across the sector, finances here are tight and no commitment to any upgrades can be given at this time. The current van is used for the transport of goods and staff, and any alteration to such would mean that the van would then be unusable for its intended purpose. But as you were saying, I don't know if they obviously don't have the money to get a second van. The board of Spike Island Development Company would also like to put on record that since its opening in 2016, Spike Island has strived to make the site as wheelchair friendly as possible. Obviously, with the structure being over two centuries old and parts in the entire island listed as a national monument, there are some areas that will remain untouched as we are required to maintain the original structures. Spike Island Development Company have added two wheelchair accessible pontoons and added a larger ferry suitable for wheelchair users. 10 out of the 12 exhibition spaces on Spike Island are also wheelchair accessible, and there's a paved wheelchair friendly walkway from the pier. That's the one that your family used up to the fortress, but it had to be pushed. Since the installation of the pontoons and walkways in 2019, Spike Island has welcomed many wheelchair users, and there has been no record of complaints regarding the accessibility. As per the wishes of the McShane family, we are not currently planning any exhibitions on the life of Kay McShane. Are they your wishes, Anne, that you know?
No, not at all, Joe. And in fact, I've written to Spike about this because they've given that same response to Minister O'Gorman, who raised the question with them recently. We have never said that we want to withdraw the exhibition. What we want is for Spike Island to do what they agreed to do back in 2020 and to provide access for disabled people so that they could go to this exhibition. And like, there is no point in them providing ramps and pontoons if when the disabled person gets to the other side, they can't get on the bus. And the majority of people would not get up that hill easily. And it really is wrong. Like, you say that the bus wasn't really for passengers. Well, I've seen it sitting at the pier and you can get on it if you're going to have a difficulty getting up the hill.
Yeah, but you can't get on it if you're in a wheelchair. That's your point.
Well, exactly. But I'm saying that, like, why would you provide that for people who are, you know, find it difficult on their feet, and yet the people who can't walk can't get on it at all? Like, we've made it really clear we very much want this exhibition to happen. We handed over all Kay's medals, her trophies, her photographs, her... I'm sorry. We handed over everything. Yeah, we have hardly anything ourselves. Yeah. We've left it with Spike because we thought that this would happen. There's no way that we can have an exhibition which isn't accessible, Joe. Yeah, and it makes no sense for Spike Island to be saying that they've done all these other things and yet they won't adapt the bus. Like, it's €8,000. Like, €8,000 isn't a huge amount of money in this day and age. And we offered to fundraise. And actually, in the letter that was sent to Spike by a number of people, including Sonia Sullivan and the Irish Association, they've said there are all of these grants. Sonia Sullivan, in fact, said she's very nice about it because she actually remembers Kay from when she was a young teenager herself, and when Kay led out the women's mini marathon in 1984 in Cork. You know, like, she was somebody who would be noticed because of her determination and the fact that she was somebody who was one of the innovators and a very determined person, a real fighter. And I know that she would be behind us today on this. Like, Kay is gone. Yeah, yeah. But there's still loads of other people who are excluded from cultural events and venues. And we think that this particular fight is not just about us. And at this stage, to be honest, Joe, like, I'm kind of not stressed, but, you know, like, it's not nice to have to talk about, you know, this situation again and again and to feel that Spike is misrepresenting us. But what we feel now is that, like, there's all these other people who've come behind us and who've said, like, Anne, you're speaking for us, And I feel that it's only a bus, Joe. It's only a bus. And well, that good money could be found.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully. It's a work. The spiker saying everything on the island is a work in progress. But it's unfortunate that given your sister's connection with the island and your family connection with the island, but anyway, Anne, hopefully this might encourage someone maybe to give the money for a wheelchair, an accessible bus.
That's true.
But okay, Anne, kind regards and condolences on the passing. Thank you so much, Anne. That's Anne. Anne McShane. More stuff from the Special Criminal Court. I mentioned about Dowdall going to the solicitor going to the Gardaí after he was arrested to see could he assist the Gardaí. At the conclusion of a meeting with the Gardaí, Dowdall was told to gather thoughts and put pen to paper. Dowdall was of the opinion the guards were to return to him. The guards were of the view that he was to come back to them. Dowdall was asked, this again is the judge's narrative from in the last few minutes from their listening to 52 days of evidence. Dowdall was asked how he wanted the situation to end up. He said he was willing to give evidence. He met Gardaí again on the 12th of July and further info was imparted in relation to the Regency killing. The letter dated the 2nd of August sent to Gardaí set out a history of communications and referenced necessity for an all prosequi on the murder charge if Dowdall was to give evidence. Hutch's counsel suggested it showed lack of interest by the Gardaí in what Dowdall had to say. The court tends to agree. Judge Bourne then says the court is of the view the investigating team had concerns about an nolle prosequi being entered. On the 12th of September, the DPP accepts plea of guilty to the facilitation charge. That's by Dowdall. On the 16th of September, the DPP confirmed to Dowdall's solicitor that this would be acceptable. Justice Bourne says statement was taken from Dowdall after a long drawn-out process 10 days before the trial. It cannot be said Jonathan Dowdall, the court has said, found God. He was acting out of self-interest, the judge said. He was asking to get into a witness protection programme. Judge Bourne says the court is of the view Jonathan Dowdall obtained a significant benefit by providing a statement to an Garda Síochána. Judge Bourne went on, the court is in no doubt if someone wants to make life for himself in the perilous situation he's now in, it is Jonathan Dowdall. She then spoke about the Dowdall's conviction for the torture of a man. You heard that earlier in the programme. She said this was truly shocking. The court was asked to view the recording. They declined to do so because it was not in dispute. She says what took place in the garage, you heard Alex Hurley, the victim, over on this programme a few minutes ago, over a two-hour period was truly appalling and shocking. Justice Bourne says the fact that Dowdall involved in such a vicious attack is disturbing. However, a person who commissions such a crime can still give truthful evidence, as she says. However, lots of howevers. However, in court, Dowdall accepted in this court that he had lied before to a special criminal court hearing. It is a matter this court must account for. That's in the last few minutes. Back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now that you've heard Alex Hurley and you heard it an hour ago, Jonathan Dowdall talking to Liveline and denying everything about, didn't even mention the fact that I've never done anything. Listen to Jonathan Dowdall again as we await, might not come before 3 o'clock, as we await a verdict based on Jonathan Dowdall's evidence against Gerard Hutch. Jonathan, you're all over the front page of the lot of newspapers today about your house being raided. What happened?
Life is upside down at the moment, Joe, to tell you the truth. My family are in an awful state. Daughter won't go to work. She won't go to college. My house was raided, and as you say, other than that, I didn't make it public, but the guards did that. They notified the press, as far as I'm aware. And the house was raided under Section 9 as being a suspected member of the IRA, and they were in search of firearms and explosives. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason why the help. I don't know why that is. It was a complete shock to me. The first I was seeing and knowing of it was a lot of armed guards coming to the house. I just happened to be able to open the door on time, and they didn't burst through the door, and then I was held at gunpoint in the house. I was more than cooperative to the guards. They were looking for an office that we left 3 or 4 years ago, and I told them our office was around the back, and they were there from people. It reported in the media that they were there from yesterday morning, which it wasn't true. They were there from the night before from 7:45 that night.
Okay.
They turned the house, told us to get out of the house. I wasn't cautioned or arrested at any point or questioned about anything, and I don't know what it's in relation to, and they wouldn't let me. If I left the room, I was held at gunpoint. I put the dogs away for them to search the house. At one point then, when we did leave, my wife came back to the house, and there was a guard sitting in the house on his own at 10 o'clock. We thought he was searching the house through the night. He was sitting there on the sofa with a machine gun watching the telly. Joe, we run a business, as you know. I met you before. I've run a business since 2007. I've never been on a social welfare payment in my life. I've worked my whole life. I ran in the elections. I'm sure I've no criminal convictions whatsoever for a breach of the peace probably 20 years ago. I've no links, connections to criminality or any crime organisations in any shape or form. Like any business today, my company is always overdraft. I borrow, which I've proof of, I borrow money from the credit union around the corner certain weeks and I'm waiting for payment to come in to pay the lads so they don't go home without wages. It's not a cash business in any shape or form. It's an electrical company, and I can't name the companies for legal reasons, and hopefully they will be supportive to me to straighten this out. But it's all big international companies, and that bank transfers, that's the 60-day credit term, 90-day credit term. And it's not a case where I do a reword on 5,000 or 10,000, or I'm claiming when money is put in account. That never happens. It's every penny is traceable. The car that there was 4 cars, company Jeep. There was my daughter's car, which is a Mini, which is in my name, which is, it has finance on it, along with the Jeep has finance on it. They didn't take them. They were letting me take my BMW that night, but they searched it. But they moved it into a spot that looked good for the press. And they said the reason why they weren't let me take it was they were to search it again. That car has finance on it, or previous to that, which had finance on it. And, to this day, I'm still breaking my arse like everybody else to pay for the car. My motorbike, right to the point of buying it, has proof for everything on it. The police notified the papers about a pond. Other than that, they've never seen that. The divers in the pond.
Tell us about that, John, because the Garda Subaqua unit arrived at your house on the Navan Road. What was that about?
I keep Japanese koi, Joe, since I'm a kid.
Okay.
And I keep dogs as well. And I was always fascinated by fish, and it's a hobby. And I keep them, and I've docked their friends and all age, and I'm actually good at keeping them, and I grow.
Okay, you can keep listening to that. It'll be on our podcast. The judge saying, this is Orla O'Donnell now, our own court correspondent, saying the manner in which Dowdall told these convincing lies was extremely concerning for the court. What the convincing lies that the judge is referring to are the ones you've just heard. She mentions his phone call to Joe Duffy, in which he said he'd never been involved in criminality, previous lies to the Special Criminal Court, and lie after lie to Gardaí. The judge said this raised the phone call to Joe Duffy that you've just been listening to, the lies to the Special Criminal Court, and lie after lie told to Gardaí. This raised a significant question, and says a significant question mark hangs over Jonathan Dowdall's character and reliability.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
The tape suggests, again, the judge in the last few minutes at the Special Criminal Court, the tape suggests a ruthless-based, callous criminal involved in making bombs, suggesting assassinations. Those who were involved in the Hutch organised crime group. The judge said the manner in which Jonathan Dowdall told these lies, these convincing lies, were extremely concerning for the court. On the tape, he talked about making bombs. Dowdall did. A real question, who was the court actually dealing with? A significant question mark hangs over Dowdall and what he says. The court must assert his truthfulness about Jerry Hutch with scepticism. One would expect he would tell the full account truthfully, warts and all, but he says this was not the case. He came to court to tell a specific story, this is the judge, but was reluctant to speak about other things. His relationship, Dowdall's relationship with IRA terrorist Pierce McCauley is an example, she says. He was reluctant to speak about this and only accepted the relationship with him when he was... The prison visit records were produced in court. He told a barefaced lie, Dowdall did, to the court about how many times he met McCauley. Justice Bourne says very specific plots were raised to harm people by Dowdall on the tape. He claimed he was stressed out. Jonathan Dowdall was stressed out at the time. But Judge Bourne says he doesn't sound stressed out to me on the tape. Today's producer was Annette Egan. Ray Darcy's next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.